Accession number 11261, real sex.
Said I go yes, in some details.
Can I just introduce Dr. Pravulovic, real sex, isn't
it? I think it is, yes.
This was the 24th of May.
24th of May. And by then, excuse me, it's old age. Sorry, what I was saying.
You were going to tell me about the details of the day.
Well, the day before, that was the 23rd. Now, I was an officer, junior officer, but I was in the, you know, sort of welter, you know, region. So I wasn't in the commanding section, so a command, a company commander or whatever, anyway. But I think it was only the commanders of our regiment, you know, the commanding officers and their adjutants, and I don't know what their assistant commanders were called, anyway. Only the top officers. They were asked to go to this meeting with the British authorities. And then they came back after that meeting and they conveyed to us this. And as I said, everybody was absolutely over the moon. They were elated, they were rejoicing. It was downpour with rain all night, but people were happy and singing and dancing and getting ready and, you know, pulling their tents down. And so everything was ready. We were asked to be ready at some very early hour in the morning. Yes, we were, and we waited there, and eventually we were taken to the place where we were supposed to assemble. And trucks came round there, and each truck took so many of us. Now, the British soldiers were armed, but not, you know, they carried the searchers, individual searchers. But they were not all that rigorous or stern, as they proved to be later. We thought this was just part of routine, I presume. You know, they got, you know, take certain precautions, and we were told, you know, to take only so much food and to leave everything else behind. We were given so many motorcyclists, or people were, you know, sort of scrambling out who is going to be the lucky one to ride a motorcycle, and who is going to sort of, you know, drive along in a car, and all this, and you see, look what our allies have done for us. You're just just unbelievable. And when we came then later on to Maria Elend, of course there were tanks lined up on all sides, British soldiers with bayonets fixed, very stern, very green-faced, very threatening, very rigorous searches. And, you know, so officers were separated from the rank and files. I was one of the few officers who managed to... I did not join with the officers because there was obviously they were taken separately in a third-class compartment, but the rest of us were put in cattle wagons. But I stayed with... I felt that it was my duty now to be with my people. I mean, after all, I was their education officer, so... I felt that, you know, I should desert them at this time.
Did you realize that something was very seriously wrong at this stage?
Not yet, really. I mean, you know, although you realize you may moments of doubt and uncertainty, you're still trying to convince yourself that perhaps it isn't as black as it might be. I mean, after all, you know, I was present there when... the British major was saying, yes, you are going to Italy, and, you know, and my word of honor and all this. And so when you are given assurances like that, you expect people to live up to it. Well, it turned out that we were misguided. There had been, you know, some British soldiers, even while we were still in the camp, who had warned some of our people, you know, not me directly, but I heard about it. Say you are being sent to Tito, you know, so... Again, people were not inclined to believe this or take it seriously. I think, I'm not sure of this, I mean, this is only guesswork. Some people may have taken it more seriously and may have absconded, but that would be a very, very minimal, because most of us were just not prepared to take such warning seriously. Said, no, that couldn't be. You know, look, they've done this, and they've given us this, and they've given them this, and all the trouble is being taken. But of course, when you are faced with bayonet fixed and very rigorous searching, and then taken in groups of so many to each compartment, then you realize. And then we were taken to these very, you know, the composition, a train composition came into the station, you see, as I pulled up. The officers were taken first, and then each group was taken to another cattle wagon. The doors were locked behind us, locked and then sealed. I think, you know, you had the impression, obviously, you know, you couldn't do much about it from the inside, but just little cuttings for windows. Even then, I describe this in some detail here, I still naively believe that no, it can't be, you know, because the British soldiers are still with us, the British guards are still with us. No, it couldn't be anything. And it was only when the train started, well, just about to start, moved forward a little bit, and then suddenly the Tito's guards and, you know, soldiers came out of the station building and took occupation of the train, every compartment, and, you know, especially went to the officers, you know, compartment first, and then took places along the train. Then we realized, well, that seems to be it. So, but even then, you know, later on, I sort of go on naively, sort of fooling myself, saying, no, look at the names of the places, look, we are going westwards, we're not going eastwards, you know. So all sorts of feeble excuses were being found to you know, just find an explanation. But of course, eventually it proved that it was all misguided and quite wrong.
When did you realise that you were in Yugoslavia and not Italy?
Well, it was, you know, the same sort of, you know, on the same journey we were taken through the tunnel, and then when we reached Kranj, one of the smaller towns not far from the border, and then we asked some people there where we were. They told us, yes, we are here in Yugoslavia and Kranj, and so we got our bearings and. Then from there we were taken off the train, and it was Tito's birthday, I think, or that day as well. So there were fantastic celebrations all over the place, shooting everywhere. I mean, not, you know, shooting for rejoicing. And we were taken to this temporary camp, which was not a camp really, just, you know, a field, you know. Rounded up by, you know, barbed wire and the guards around. There we spent the night on the soil.
Treat you, the guards, the partisans?
Well, not very friendly. They gave us some soup or whatever it was, but of course they came round plundering, threatening, and they were using their usual, you know, propaganda tactics. They would say, nothing will happen to you, don't be afraid, if you haven't committed any crimes, you'll go back to your place, you know, the country is in dire need for, you know, as much work as possibly can be done, it needs to be reconstructed in all spheres of life, you'll go back, and if you haven't committed any crime, then, of course, you'll be allowed either to go home or to join the army. And, of course, if you are guilty for something, then, you'll be tried like everybody else. And many people accepted this. And, you see, these false assurances were carried out also by some people in the camp. As I said early on, there were people who had been communist agents. I know one of them was our veterinary officer, and we knew him. You know, we knew. I mean, he was caught as a communist agent. He was with us, not exactly of his own will, but various others. You know, some people that we didn't suspect to be, or people who lost their marbles at that time, and you know, they became warriors. So I said, right, if we do this, we will ingratiate ourselves to our new masters. Perhaps, you know, we'll have a lucky escape. And so this propaganda was working very, well, you know, over time, as it were. And then many people started believing this. And said, because if you are not an officer, you have nothing to worry about. We need every possible person we can get to help with the reconstruction and so on. Because we knew fully well what would happen. And anyway, it never came to this anything, because during the next two or three days, practically all those people were dead, except, you know, the few who escaped.
So before I ask you about your escape and what you know about the deaths of the other, I wonder how you felt about the British soldiers who told you that you were going to Italy, and you explained how one officer, on his word of honour, promised that. You know, I wonder,
Major Johnson.
Yes.
Well, how can you feel? I presume we felt very bitter. I must say, very bitter. We felt that we've been betrayed. We felt that we haven't deserved this kind of treatment. Right? We haven't. We haven't exactly endeared ourselves to the British, but on the other hand, we have not fought against the British, we have not fought against the Americans, we have not fought against the Russian Red Army. We have only fought against our own internal enemies. Now, in this case, yes, the Germans had to be on the same side, and, well, we had no option, we had to do it. Now, those people obviously were misguided. They thought we were the worst criminals, the scum of the earth, and I presume, you know, they tended to treat us like this. Again, you see, a greater deal of information that they got was from Tito's officers. I mean, they had their liaisons, they had their officers for liaison officers in every with every unit, and of course there was constant contact with them at the very highest level. I mean, at Toby Law and General Cakely and others were having conferences with Kochvar and various others when they arranged for the, you know, return of the Ustashes. All right. You can say perhaps Ustashes deserve this, but even they, although they wore the German uniform, they worked with the Germans as their allies, the Germans brought them to power, even they should surely have been given some trial, some chance to say, were they all criminals? Were they all Ustashes? Did they all deserve this? Many of them deserved, and many of them were criminals. If not towards anybody else, then in regard to the Serbian population, which suffered so heavily at their hands, and they were merciless and absolutely, you know, very cruel to them, and, you know, murderous. As I said, I mean, it's no exaggeration to say that near to 2 million people of our people perished, and most of them in Croatia at the hands of Ustashes, far more than from Germans or Italians or Bulgarians or Albanians, anybody else. I think all those taken together are nowhere near the number of people massacred or killed or butchered by the Ustashes. But even they that didn't deserve, you know, all right. The Germans have done the same, if not worse, things. And if the Germans were entitled to have a, you know, sort of fair trial, there was Nuremberg, there were various other, you know, tribunals, why not those people? But our fault was, unfortunately, we fought against Tito. He knew this. He knew that we were avowed enemies of communism and that kind of regime which was he was trying to impose and eventually imposed on our people. And he just wanted to get us out of the way, that there is no opposition. during those last few months while he was in Slovenia, he mobilized hundreds of thousands of mainly peasant youths, young men, who were pushed to the front line against the Germans in the regions of eastern of Danube and Sava. Against the Germans, they were mowed down in thousands, literally. There were so many thousands of them were massacred there. But Tito didn't worry about it. All he was interested in was to achieve his objective, to become the master of that unfortunate nation. And how many people were lost? And those were innocent people, all right, who were criminals. But they were taken from their homes in their early teens or late teens, or hardly anybody beyond. But the flower of the youth, they were taken and massacred. And many of them remained unburied, and God knows where. I don't think that many of their parents found their graves or their bodies. I know some of them have later on managed to find, but not many. So...
Well, now I must ask you about, the events after this being enclosed by the partisans.
Hmm.
You have hinted, of course, and I know that you're here speaking to me,
yeah.
And you did escape. Could you tell me now about the subsequent events?
Well, from that, one night's abode, we were ordered to move the next day. I don't remember exactly what time, but quite early. And we were marched along the route. It was going past Ljubljana, going towards Medvodje. You can imagine, we were emaciated, we were weak, we were hungry, we were tired, exhausted. And we were sort of marching along in sort of formation of four. We knew that we were coming to a camp towards the end of the day, which was St. Vid. We knew that once we reached there, I don't know how, but somehow we had this premonition that once you're there, there would be no chance of escaping. And I was, again, in virtue of my duty, which I was doing as a welfare and education officer, I felt it was my responsibility to find out, to feel the pulse of the people. So I didn't somehow... After one of our rest in halls, I found myself at the end of our column, or the end of my regiment. And so I was, we were surrounded by guards on all sides, from right and left, in front, behind us. But anyway, the guards were on both sides as we were marching along. And... I knew that something was being planned, this kind of escape. So I was trying to feel the pulse of these people and say, well, how do they feel about this? And of course, some of them were for this. Others were very skeptical, say, oh, nothing will happen to us. Look, they all sound so civilized and, reasonable. And if we go, I have done nothing, so there's nothing to be afraid of. Say, fair enough, yes. All right, now I haven't done anything. I haven't killed anybody or murdered, but nonetheless, there you are. Anyway, it was interesting, and I had to be careful as I was moving forward not to be noticed by the guards. So... I had to merge in this milieu. If they noticed there were five people instead of four, it would be, they would start following that up. Anyway, I managed to get through the whole column, gradually, in the course of, two or three hours. So I had a fairly good idea how people would react. We stopped at one place. This was... immediately before the breakout, we were allowed to go and get some water. with some guards, obviously, but my battalion commander and somebody else managed to escape then. They just disappeared. I don't know how. Anyway, they were lucky. Anyway, everybody was delighted that they managed to get away at that stage. We had a kind of signal which was to be given by the, you know, commanding officer when he said something, you know, when he threw his blanket or, you know, the rucksack that he was carrying, then that would be the signal for us to try and break out. And we were coming here to this camp. We could see already, you know, floodlights and, you know, so, and rockets, you know, so being fired, and, you know, as part of jubilation, as part of in anticipation of this prey that is coming for their planned massacre. And there was this river on that side, deep river, guarded, not easily, you know, fordable or swimmable, but heavy guards ahead of us, and I was near the head of the column. In fact, I must have been amongst the first dozen or so people, because I was literally behind the commanding officer there. There was a wheat field to our right, as if I'm looking at it now. And then a big forest behind it. The signal was given. And we started dispersing. Now, it must have taken our guards by such surprise. They were quite stunned. And for, you know, a minute or two, there was no response from them whatsoever. In fact, some of them were disarmed. I remember one of my company commanders took the rifle or gun, whatever it was, from his guard. But he sort of spoke to him, "Oh, don't do this, you know, nothing will happen to you." He handed him back his rifle and went back into the, you know, to join the rest. Anyway, a number of us managed to get out of the column through the field and then into the forest. And then the shooting started. But they were, again, quite craftily, and communist guards were shouting, "Don't do this, don't run away, nothing will happen to you. Only those who are guilty are trying to escape," and all that. I think one reason why they didn't bother to chase us was that they knew that we wouldn't stand much of a chance anyway, because they were everywhere. The earth was heavy with these soldiers, with their troops. I mean, you know, they knew every bridge was, you know, occupied and guarded. Every crossing was guarded. People were conditioned to report to them anybody, you know, roaming about whom they didn't know. So they felt pretty confident that, it doesn't matter if we don't get them. They may be away for a few hours or a day or two, but they'll fall into our hands, you know, before long. Anyway, I remember in this particular group we were 9 of us. I was in the group with the commanding officer, you know, one of those was either at the end or somewhere there, it doesn't matter. And again, it was dark, fighting through this forest and trying to keep in contact with the person in front of you, otherwise you're lost. And anyway, soon after we were separated, we were reduced to 4. With the others went their way, we went another way. Shooting was going everywhere. Pandemonium was breaking loose. We carried on for some time. Again, you dare not stop. You want to get as far away from this as possible, and you're taking all the chances. But the philosophy behind this was, bad nerves. We are going to take a chance. We didn't think there was much of a chance for escaping, but at least we thought we would provoke them to shoot at us and to kill us, because we didn't want to face torture in torment after, you know, and that they can be terrible. I said, right, well, all right, we'll provoke them, they can kill us, and it will be easy death. And that will be the end of it. Anyway, we managed, and we were going on for some time. We had one or two narrow escapes. We had to cross one or two bridges. Dogs were barking here and there, giving away the game. Then sometime during the night, we heard a noise from the woods. We didn't know who it was, and so we had to approach it carefully. Anyway, eventually we managed to identify one of our men. He was a battalion commander who had escaped, and he was on his own. So he came and joined us. So we again had a group of five. We carried on from there, and it went on. Again, I describe this in some detail here, you know, sort of what happened during the next fortnight or so. And two or three days later, we were reduced to two. I on my own, and Mr. Stankovic, who is in London now, and he was at the trial as well. And then again, a day or so later, again we were trapped. Like how we were not killed or captured at that time, I don't know. Even today, it surpasses my comprehension. We were separated, so I was left on my own. I managed to reach the river Isonzo. And there I was within the sight of Italy and freedom. You want me to carry? It was a very adventurous escape before then. I mean, there are so many exciting details and so many unbelievable escapes that, you know, if I had been an unbeliever or an atheist, I would have realized that somebody was, you know, there was something guiding me and protecting in those days. Because, quite frankly, I mean, no human being could have done those things on his own, by his own devices, however clever you may think you are, however brave you may think you are. I mean, it was just unbelievable. But anyway, it happened. I went through all these, and, you know, quite a few of these are described here. You may find that of some interest. But I was there on the riverbank of Isonzo, watching the American soldiers across the river, almost ready to, willing to shout to them, because they couldn't do much there. I mean, after all, I spent that night in a sort of old Roman ruins. You know, there were some monuments, some monuments left there. So I spent that, and I was able to get some corn grains from the field, so I stuffed my pockets. And then in the morning, as it was becoming obvious where I was, I noticed there was a cave right hard by the river bank. So I managed to climb up there, out of sight of, you know, any unwanted wanderer. So I spent the day there, although, you know, some Tito's patrols came very close to me, but it didn't occur to them to come up and see or have a look in this cave. I mean, and I would have been there finished. The day before this, before I came to the Isonzo, I was caught. Oh, God. I must tell you this. As I was making my way through, I came through an encampment of, you know, tents. I recognized they must be Yugoslav tents because they were shabby and improvised. I mean, and not what the British or the Americans would have. Because by the time I find myself there, it was too late.